So I'm going to try to do something a little bit difficult tonight. And during the week, it was like, I'm not sure if I should do it. But I'm going to try to preach on one verse tonight. And it's really not all that deep. So we'll see how this goes. But it doesn't fit totally with what we talked about last week. And it doesn't really fit. I mean, if I would have stuck it in with chapter 4, it would have just been kind of a tagline. So, you know, we've got a judge named here. And that's why most of you don't know who he is. So that's our title tonight, is Sham Who. I thought about Sham Wow, but I figured there's probably a copyright on that from the infomercial. And I might get in trouble. So this is about a judge that we don't talk about very much. So here's the layout of the sermon tonight. There'll be a little bit for everybody. We'll dig into the verse a little bit historically and try to put it in context on who this is and what he did and where it fits. And then we'll spend the second half on some real practical application on maybe some lessons we can learn from the verse. At least that's my intent. So we'll see how God leads us tonight. But tonight's judge is not an Othniel that we covered a couple weeks back. Othniel was qualified. He had the heritage. He had the lineage. He was connected to Caleb. He had won battles before. He was filled with the Spirit of the Lord. You know, he was the guy that's not surprising at all that won the battle. And he's not even an Ehud. Ehud was not exactly Othniel, but he was a pretty brave guy. He must have been pretty prominent. He was carrying money to the king. He must have been pretty important. Shamgar is probably a foreigner. And if he is an Israelite, based on his name, which we don't really get in the English, but when I show you here in a second, based on his name, if he is an Israelite, he's an Israelite with a Canaanite name. Okay? So what that tells you is if he is an Israelite, then his family has kind of gone off the deep end theologically because they're naming their kids not after Hebrew names, but after Canaanite names. Okay? So at the very least, he's a Canaanized Israelite. I think he might probably be a foreigner here based on the lack of information that we have. So 331 is our verse tonight, the last verse of chapter 3, before we get into Deborah in chapter 4. And so it is, and after him, after Ehud, was Shamgar, the son of Anath, which slew of the Philistines 600 men with an ox goad, and he also delivered Israel. So you imagine, I'm going to preach on that verse tonight. That is the plan. But so for us, this verse really raises more questions than it does give us answers, because we don't know anything about him. There's nothing there that gives us any information other than what he did. So let's kind of try to dig into this a little bit. Here's what we don't know. How and where was this Philistine oppression felt? Where in Israel was this? We don't know. We're not sure where this is. Who is this guy? We don't know who he is. We don't have a family background. His dad or whoever this Anath is not a famous name. How did he emerge as the champion of Israel? We don't get the lead up. We got the whole Ehud story. We don't get much here. How could he have slaughtered 600 Philistines who are known to be a great military force with an ox goad, with a stick? He killed 600 men with a stick. Okay? And what effect did his heroic deeds have on Israel? We don't really know. We just know there was an occurrence where a man delivered Israel during this time. And he's called a deliverer, a savior of Israel. Okay? So something big happened here, but we don't have a whole lot of detail. So what can we learn? Where does he fit? Okay, so a little bit of history here, but several factors suggest that Shamgar's victory took place sometime during the 98 years described in the previous section. So Othniel and Ehud covers about 98 years. Shamgar's probably in there somewhere. Okay, because remember, after Ehud, you get 80 years of rest. So it's somewhere in that. Remember, they were oppressed for 18 years and they had 80 years of rest. After Ehud came Shamgar. So it's sometime during that same period. And then you'll see when we go to verse 4, chapter 4, verse 1, it says, and the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord when Ehud was dead. So it goes up to verse 30 and talks about Ehud. Then it mentions Shamgar. Then it goes back to Ehud. So based on that, I feel like Shamgar must have happened in that same time period. Following that? Okay. There's no reference to Israel doing evil in Yahweh's sight in this verse, like every other one, right? The Israelites started doing evil in the sight of the Lord, and he sent so-and-so to deliver them. We don't have that formula here. The length of the Philistine oppression must have been pretty long. The writer doesn't mention a number of years that the land enjoyed rest. So this seems to be a unique case. Evidently, during this 98-year period, the Philistines also oppressed Israel. So I've got 4 points on the historical side. Okay, point number one, Shamgar appeared on the scene after Ehud's assassination of Eglon and his military victory over the Moabite army. How soon after? I don't know. We don't really know, but sometime after the assassination of last week happened. And the Song of Deborah is going to mention Shamgar. Chapter 5, verse 6 says, in the days of Shamgar, the son of Anath, in the days of Jael, the highways were unoccupied and the travelers walked through the byways. So he's important enough for an Israelite woman, an Israelite judge, to mention him in her song. Okay, so they would have, I've said this with other lessons and stuff before. You don't drop names if they don't mean anything. You know, if I'm telling a story and I tell you somebody that was there, then I expect you to know who that person is. Okay, I don't just say, you know, Jimmy was there. Oh, well, that doesn't help me. If I tell you this guy was there, you know he was there. It was important. There's a name drop there. The song suggests that Shamgar was a contemporary of Deborah, Barak, and Jael, which we will see in the next chapter, which is another great story in what happened in Israel. But the historical context of the figures is really difficult to fix. So here's what I can get you to at this point is we don't know exactly when this happened. Okay? We have a big chunk of years where it could have. So one issue is when we think of the Philistines in the book of Judges, who immediately comes to mind? Who fought the Philistines?
Samson.
Okay? Now, how long is it going to be until we get to Samson? And he's like chapter 13, okay? So he's way down the line. So what are the skeptics going to say to this? They're going to go, this is a late addition. Somebody threw this in here because the Philistines weren't even the Philistines yet when Shamgar was fighting, okay? Now, on the first hand, there's some truth to that. They weren't the Philistines yet, but they did exist and they were around Israel. So that's what I want to establish here, okay? Shamgar is associated with Ehud, not Samson and Samuel. So this is not the same campaign that Samson fights in years and years later. This is different, and I think it's different geographically too. Since he appears much early in the settlement period, perhaps his battles against the Philistines happened when the first waves of what we call the historians call the Sea Peoples. The Sea Peoples came from Europe and from Crete and from Cyprus, and they swept into the Near East in these next couple hundred years. And those are the people that will become the Philistines. But remember way back to the first verse of the very first lesson, do you remember who we said is the likely author of Judges? Well, we think it might have been Samuel. Well, what would Samuel have called the Sea Peoples? He would have called them Philistines because he's dealing with them right. When Samuel's writing, he's still dealing with the Philistines. So he would have called them that, even if it was, it'd be like us if we're talking about the early founding fathers, 200 years ago. We'd still call them Americans. Even though we might not have been the United States of America yet, those were American colonists. We would still call them that. Does that make sense? So they're going to become the Philistines. They began to encroach upon the regions occupied by the Israelites. So in other words, he fought these people before the Philistines were the Philistines. Before the Philistines hit it big and became the Philistines, they were still there, and Shamgar was probably fighting against them. So here's the initial map. See, they came from Europe, and they came from over here in Greece, and they came across, and their first forays into the Near East were up here. Israel's down here. Okay, so they came in into the north. And when we see next chapter, you'll see Deborah and Barak fighting against forces in the north. So it seems that Shamgar was fighting the Philistines in the north. Well, the Philistines, when they get all settled, will go down here in the southwest. But right now, the Sea Peoples are still up north. Are y'all following me? Is that making sense? I know it's history. Hang with me. We'll get to the application in a little bit. The first base of the land operations of the Sea Peoples were located in northern Lebanon. That's up here. Okay? That's to the north of Israel. Tyre, Sidon, Phoenicia. Okay? That's where they initially came into the land. So the first time the Israelites had to fight them, it was in the north, not in the south. When Samson fights them, it'll be in the south. When Samuel fights them, it'll be in the south as they invade from the south. Right now, they're still up north. So it actually fits really well in the description. Okay, point two, his name. Shamgar, the son of Anath. So the name suggests that he was not Hebrew, but Canaanite. If you want to get really specific, the most of the commentators say he was Hurrian, whatever that means. He was, I guess, a division of the Canaanites. Furthermore, son of Anath means he was devoted to the service of Anath, the consort of Baal, and the goddess of war in Canaanite mythology. So he is the son of a pagan goddess. That's what it says. So you'll hear some commentators, I'm reading commentaries, and they're like, that was his father's name. Are you telling me his father was named after a pagan goddess? I don't think that's what it is. Normally, son of whoever is the son of whoever, but I don't think that's the case in this, unless we got a boy named Sue situation going on here where his dad was named after a pagan goddess. I just don't think that fits really well. So Anath was also an Egyptian goddess, and watch how this kind of comes together. History nerds will like this part. I think it's kind of cool. Aneth was considered the personal protectress of Pharaoh. She was the goddess of war in the Egyptian canon, and she protected Pharaoh. That was the belief. And so why is that important? Well, here's a big long sentence, but let me explain this to you. They found an inscription. Archaeologists found an inscription at this place called the Wadi Hammamat. A wadi is a dried out riverbed. So anytime you see on a map, you see a wadi, it's a dried out riverbed. So they found that in this wadi, they found this inscription. It's dated to the third year of Ramses IV. That's 1164 BC. That's some good archaeology when you find something that old. And it has this reading on it where it says the PRW of the troop of Aneth, 800 men. So it seems like what's being described here is a group of mercenary soldiers called the Sons of Aneth that fought for Pharaoh. Okay? And so apparently when Pharaoh would fight different people, he would get some extra soldiers. He would pay mercenaries, and they would come in, and they were the Sons of Aneth. That was what they called themselves, okay? And that's the nickname for their group. And so I think that may be something here. So assuming that same troop fought against the Sea Peoples during the reign of Ramses III, and Ramses III went up north and fought the Philistines, okay? So you're seeing how this is all coming together. Egypt did fight against them, and Egypt has a record of a group of people called the Sons of Aneth that fought in an army. I think that may be where we get Son of Aneth from, as he was a warrior in this group. And so in that case, a man of valor in this company would have used the military name Ben Aneth, or Son of Aneth. And so that may be what's going on, which brings up an important point that Shamgar may be totally oblivious that he is delivering Israel from the Philistines. He may lead this great battle and kill all these Philistines and win a battle for Pharaoh while at the same time delivering Israel from the Philistine oppression that was coming in. I think it's possible because his name is just so strange. You don't have Israelites named after Canaanite things. It just usually doesn't happen that way. And if they are, they're not good people when that thing happens. So in Judges 5:6, Deborah associates Shamgar with problems in northern Israel. So there's a good possibility that his confrontation with the Philistines occurred in the north at the beginning of the 12th century BC. And this also raises another possibility, what I just said. Shamgar was not intentionally serving Israelite interests, but his heroics benefited them directly by relieving them of Philistine pressure for quite some time. So he was such a great general that Israel gave him credit for what he did to deliver them from this enemy force that could have come in and taken care of them. So here's some possible origins for the name. And think about this. This is really difficult. Well, we got seven possible answers on why he has this name. Well, one is he may have been a mercenary soldier rather than a Hebrew. Okay. Number two, his name suggests that he might have been a religious Canaanite. Maybe he was a Canaanite that was superstitious and religious. He's a son of Aneth because he worships Aneth. Okay. Number three, another suggestion that Son of Aneth indicated that Shamgar was like Aneth, namely of a warlike character. So I guess if you were Roman, you'd be a son of Mars, that kind of thing. I'm on the right track, right? Mars is Roman, right? Ares is Greek, right? I'm with it? All right. So, and then Shamgar could have been the son of a mixed marriage. Maybe one of his parents was an Israelite, one of his parents was a Canaanite. That's a possibility with the name as well. Perhaps he was a proselyte to Yahweh worship. Maybe he was born a Canaanite and he came over and he converted to be a Hebrew and now he's fighting on their behalf. That's a possibility too. And there's one reason why I don't totally go whole hog in on the mercenary side, and we'll talk about it in a second, but it's the weapon that he uses. If you're a professional soldier, you're not rolling into battle with an ox goad. So that's what gives me pause on the other side, even though I like a lot of the evidence that points that way. Some commentators connect Ben Aneth with this place called, there was a city called Ben or Aneth in Naphtali, so the house of Aneth. Well, maybe he's the son of that city. That's what some people will say. And then many assume Aneth was the name of Shamgar's father, but again, I don't think that makes a lot of sense because it's a female's name. Okay? And this was not the society where men took on female names. Okay? This was back when gender was very firmly established and people had names that fit. There you go. Okay? Stop there. So our third point is the manner of victory. He slaughtered 600 Philistines with an ox goad. So it was normally used to train and control livestock. Some of you Google this and there's all kinds of goofy shaped tools that they have. Some of them have hooks on it and different kinds of things. But essentially what it did was it kept the ox going straight down the line when you were plowing the land. Okay? It's just a stick to keep the animals in line. It's probably made of hardwood. It's probably tipped with iron on the front. So, if it was a spear doesn't even, it's really not sharp enough to be called a spear. It's just a big, heavy stick. It's like a cudgel, maybe, something like that you might use. Okay? So it's a signifier of his class, probably. It's kind of one of those things where if you, we study like the American Revolution, and these militiamen would roll out from the farms and they would go fight their battles, and they would have, you know, their hunting rifles that they would bring out to fight. You know, they weren't professional soldiers. They had whatever weapons they could have. You know, they'll go fight with a pitchfork if they have to. You know, whatever they got at the farm, that's what they'll use. And I think that's what we've got going on here, because you wouldn't, if you were a great warrior, you wouldn't purposely select this. You know, it's not like, all right, I got a big battle to fight, give me the stick. You know, it's not what you would do. It's just common sense. You need something with a little more power to it than that. You know, I know they don't have rifles and stuff then, but I think I'd pick a sword or a spear or something, a javelin, a sling, something, anything would be better than a stick, right? And it's probably a fairly blunt stick on top of that. So he's probably a farmer. He's probably a farmer that that God raises up to fight this battle. It's not a weapon you take in. Again, that's what gives me pause on the Egyptian mercenary interpretation. And my thought is, leave it to the Lord to prove his providence by sending a deliverer, a great judge, into battle with a stick and killing 600 men. Okay? It's like Jericho. You know, you're going to walk around and play a trumpet and the walls are going to fall down. So nobody's going to be able to say anything, but God did this. Yeah, I mean, that's how else do you explain a guy killing 600 men with an ox goad? Okay? Now, I don't know if he did it all at once, which would be quite impressive if that's what happened. Or he's like Mr. Guerrilla Warfare guy that's just popping out behind rocks and just laying people out, you know, and he's just the scourge of the sea peoples as he lays people out. We don't really know. But realistically, it seems like that would be more the case. But again, God might just be showing off and he's just taking dudes out left and right with a stick. So who knows? I found this great cartoon. There is this artist, I'm trying to remember what his name was, Foot or Good or something like that. But these are from 1885, and they do these, and he's got all these cartoons of Bible stories. And I thought this one was kind of funny with all the Philistines embedded on the there, or impaled on the rather large ox goad that he's got there. My favorite one, if you look it up, my favorite one is Elisha and the bears attacking the children, because it's great. I can relate to Elisha in that, you know, they call him bald and stuff. And so, you know, if anybody ever calls me bald, I have scriptural license to call bears down from the forest to eat them. So, but really, an ox goad. So even though there's no mention of God in this verse, that's what the narrator is telling you, is that God is so protective of Israel that he can raise up a guy with a stick to kill 600 Philistines if he wants to. That this is a divine providence, divine protection verse, even though God's not mentioned there. It's kind of what Pastor Sean was talking about in Ruth. It may not say God, but God's all over it. Okay? And that's what this verse is all about. It is an unbelievable verse. This doesn't happen. You don't kill 600 people with an ox goad, okay? Unless God empowers you to do so. Point four, the author identifies Shamgar as a deliverer, not a ruler of Israel. Okay? He delivers, but he never rules. So again, I think the Canaanite side of this might show there. He isn't lifted up. He's not mentioned anywhere else other than that Deborah song. He's not lifted up as this great Hebrew hero. He delivers Israel, but he doesn't rule. He never has that power. So it may or may not support the belief that he was fighting for Pharaoh against the Philistines. It may support the idea that he's just a Canaanite fighting against the Philistines, or that he's a proselyte to Yahweh worship, something like that. Maybe because he was not an Israelite, we have no other information on this man who appears out of nowhere, accomplishes his task, and immediately disappears from view. I mean, you want to talk about God using people, you know, that you never expect. And you never hear from him again. He just showed up, won a battle, okay, kicked butt, took names, went back home. Okay? That's all he did. So perhaps the lack of detail in the sparse plot development, and here's where we're bridging into our application as we go through here. The lack of detail in the sparse plot development may also reflect the author's embarrassment over Israel's dependence on a foreigner for their deliverance. This is the first time they've had to depend on somebody that was not an Israelite. And maybe that's an indication that there are no Israelites stepping up to defend the land. And so God has to go outside of his family to find somebody to deliver his people, which maybe that's why the author is not giving us more detail, because there's a little bit of shame to it. And we will see a similar theme when we get to Deborah and Barak, right? Because Deborah, a woman, has to lead the charge, right? That because none of the men will step up. A similar lack of leadership going on in the next chapter. So maybe there's something to that. So the absence of native leadership in Israel represented one more symptom of the Canaanization of the people of God. Nobody cares enough to even stand up to an invading force of pagan forces coming in. Okay? And again, maybe you'll see the application coming here, but do we see this in America? Nobody, you know, remember we talked about this? The opposite of love is not hate, it's apathy. That's what I see. You know, nobody even cares enough to stand up and say anything's wrong. You know, why are there so few voices calling out about things like abortion? How do we get to a place in society where the great majority of society is totally okay with killing babies in the womb? You know, or at least okay enough where they don't say anything about it, because that would be unpopular. You know, those sorts of things. And again, we'll see this in display in the next chapter. So what does that have to do with us? Okay. John Cena doesn't even know. What does it have to do with us? Well, I wanted to look at a couple areas. And the first thing we'll start in our house and talk about lack of leadership in the church. Now, not lack of leadership in this church, but lack of leadership in the church in America. And I've got some stats for you and some different things. And then I want to look at a few of the larger churches in America and see if we can't see some common ground on what's going on with church in America. So, dependence on secular philosophies and practices increases in the church. So lack of leadership in the church, dependence on secular philosophies and practices increases in the church as godly leadership and the preaching of the gospel decrease. So where there is not godly leadership and there is not preaching of the word, churches start to look a lot like the world. Okay? And that's the church in America. Okay? We're adopting the things of the world because why? Because we don't preach the word anymore. Because we don't know the word anymore. Because nobody really knows what they believe or why they believe it anymore. And it's just become this check the box Sunday thing. Could be a social thing. Could be a status thing. You know, I go to this church because I'm important in town. You know, we've got a few of those in town, right? If you're important, you got to go to this church or this church. You couldn't go to any other church. Right? You've got that side of things going on. A church that has allowed itself to be squeezed into the mold of this world should not be surprised to find itself hostage to the world's values and methodologies. If you let them in the door, it's exactly what we see in Judges. If you let them hang around and you start intermarrying and you start letting them run the show, don't be surprised when your godly stuff starts to look a lot like them. And that's, again, it's exactly what we're seeing there. It's exactly what we're seeing now. The sin nature in man has not changed. You know, we still go after the same sins. It may look a little bit different, but we're still selfish and we're still prideful and we still do all our self-serving stuff. You know, and it just manifests itself differently in our different cultures. So look at these statistics. Every year, more than 4,000 churches close their doors and only 1,000 open up in the United States. That's 4-1 closing to opening. So you know what that looks like in 20 years and in 30 years and in 40 years? That means there's going to be less and less churches. Okay? And we already know there are less and less churches preaching the gospel. So what do those churches look like in 20 years and 30 years? Every year, 2.7 million church members fall into inactivity. So 2.7 million people are leaving the church every year that were once church members. I'm not saying they were saved. But 2.7 million people that were once church members are no longer attending every year. At the turn of the last century, 1900, there was a ratio of 27 churches per 10,000 people. In the year 2000, we had 11 churches per 10,000 people. And I'd imagine if we looked at 2020 and 2040, that number just keeps getting more and more. So here's what you've got now in the United States is we are one of the largest unreached people groups in the world. I mean, who would have ever thought that would be the case? But because of our lack of real churches in America, we have one of the largest numbers of unchurched people in the world. We're actually the third largest population-wise of unchurched people in the world in the United States. And we probably have more churches than anywhere else. And yet, we're that large. Okay? It's behind China and India as the number of people in a country that are not professing Christians. Okay, that's what's happened in this country over the last 100 years or so. Half of all churches in the U.S. did not add any new members to their ranks in the last 2 years. Think about that. 50% of churches did not add any new members. Okay? And 28% of Americans now profess to believe in biblical inerrancy. We're down to about 1 in 4 people that believe the Bible is what it says it is in this country. So, again, you want to trace some of these cultural trends. You know, I'm not saying we had 100% Christians back in the day, but at the very least, even in 1800, even if they weren't saved, they had a basic Judeo-Christian understanding of what right and wrong was. And we don't have that anymore. It's a big, Yeah, exactly right. Nobody reads them anymore. Nobody preaches them. Nobody reads them. It's not important. It is, Pastor Sean referenced the thing a few weeks back of an article, a religion reporter in Charlotte that traveled around. And he says, where's the Bible in America? And he says, it's not there. People don't read it anymore. It's not important anymore. You know, we talk about like the Bible is really important in America and the Bible Belt and this and that and the other, and it's just not. It's just not across the, you know, we are quickly moving into the minority in the country. Okay. And by the way, I'm totally okay being in the minority. I don't need to be in the majority, but just know that we're not in a majority country anymore like that. We're the smaller crowd. So my question is, the word even being preached, Lifeway did a survey of, quote, evangelicals. So these are people that identify as evangelicals, which could mean a lot of things nowadays. Okay. But these are people that identify as evangelicals. 22% said God the Father is more divine than Jesus, and 9% weren't sure. So that's 31% of evangelicals polled that do not have an accurate understanding of who God the Father and God the Son is. Okay? That's one out of three. Okay? 16% say Jesus was the first creature created by God, and 11% were unsure. So 27% think Jesus was a created being.
What year is
it? 2014. Yeah. Okay? 51% said the Holy Spirit is a force. Not a personal being. Not a person of the Trinity. Yeah, somebody's been watching too much Star Wars. Okay? Okay. 7% weren't sure, and 9% said the Holy Spirit is less divine than God the Father and Jesus. So we got not a Trinity, but a, you know, whatever two is. Duality, you know, something like that. Okay? I mean, think about it. Those are core doctrines of Christianity. We're not talking about, you know, doctrines of election and spiritual gifts. And, you know, we're not talking about that. We're talking about Jesus is God. We're talking about the deity of Christ. We're talking about the Holy Spirit is God. And we've got 25%, 30% people that don't understand that. What's the reason behind that? Because people don't preach the gospel anymore. People don't study the Bible anymore. Preachers don't do it. Okay, the gospel is not being preached in pulpits. The Bible's not being opened. I mean, all you got to do is watch some of these TV preachers. The Bible will sit right there, and they'll never even open it. Okay, it'll be story after story after story after story, and they'll never open the Bible. And people will laugh, and they'll jump up and down, and they'll cheer the funny jokes, and they'll think that they'll give them some amens, but the Bible will never open. And how do we get here? It's because the Bible doesn't open. Preachers never would have done this years ago. You know, they never would have. I mean, they'd be ashamed of themselves if they got up in a pulpit and never opened the Bible, right? But it must be happening all the time, because how do you not know the deity of Christ? Okay. 68% said that a person obtains peace with God by seeking God first, and then God responds with grace. 67% said people have the ability to turn to God on their own initiative. 55% said people have to contribute to their own salvation. 18% said God loves me because of the good I do or have done. Nobody understands the gospel in that survey. Nobody knows what grace is. Nobody knows what being called by God is. Nobody understands any of that stuff because, again, it can't be being taught, because you couldn't be that far off if you heard it even once or twice. Right? That's what the problem is. So let me go through a few churches. I did kind of a top five of the largest churches in America. Now let me talk about these churches. I'm not ripping these churches to shreds from top to bottom, because some of these churches I would not say are heretical and blasphemous. Okay? Some more than others. But they're off on things, and their presentation of church is totally different than what we would say church is. Okay? Pastor John referenced Andy Stanley. We did a podcast on this a few weeks ago. He has basically thrown inerrancy out the window. Now, he doesn't think there's any problem with that. You know, he says, I want to focus on the resurrection, not on the Bible. And I want to ask him, where did you learn about that resurrection from? You know, well, you don't need to worry about the Old Testament. Everybody knows that's not all accurate. Really, because Jesus thought it was accurate. The apostles thought it was accurate. If Adam's not real, we got a lot of problems in the New Testament. You know, it's just common sense things like that. It's like, I can drop this rock in the pool and the ripples won't cover the rest of the pool. They don't understand what goes on there. Well, Andy Stanley has 28,000 people going to six different campuses at North Point Community Church outside of Atlanta, and it's a non-denominational church. Now, I don't have a huge problem with non-denominational churches. I got saved in a non-denominational church, okay? Now, would I today go to a non-denominational church? I don't think I would. And the reason why is because you can let so many things go. Okay? Now, I know the new wave is stay away from denominations because you don't want to be called Baptist or Presbyterian or this or that because that puts you... No, but the fact is we call ourselves Baptists because we have certain core beliefs that we know we're going to lean on. This is where we stand. In a non-denominational church, you can't make stands on those issues. You kind of have to let everything go in order to stay that way. And you'll see the trend here with these large churches is most tend to be non-denominational. Because I can bring all the different stuff in. Now, again, I've mentioned this before, but 28,000 people at six different campuses. How much shepherding is going on there? You know, you guys that just went through first class, we talked about this. We want to know you. You know, how do you know 28,000 people on six different campuses that and five of them are watching you on the screen? I hope you don't go to the hospital, you know. I hope you don't need to be married. I hope you don't need some counseling because he doesn't have time for you, okay? Number four, the Christian Cultural Center in New York, Pastor A.R. Bernard, 30,000 weekly attendance, again, non-denominational. Not a lot of super red flags on the guy, but he associates with some folks that have some red flags. Okay? Again, non-denominational, you got to let some stuff go. He associates with some Word Faith teachers. He associates with some prosperity teachers. And we've talked about this. As soon as you start getting on stage with these guys and these girls, you've now endorsed their ministry. You've now legitimized their ministry. And I'll talk a little more about that with our North Carolina example in a second. Church of the Highlands in Birmingham, Alabama, same thing. 39,500 weekly attendance on 12 campuses. Okay, again, Word Faith, prosperity creeping in the door. Okay, that stuff's being let in the door at this huge church. And of course, we got old Joel down there in Houston at Lakewood Church. Okay, that's quite the sanctuary there at that's the compact center. It used to be the compact center. It's where the Houston Rockets used to play. Okay, that's where the church is. 43,500 weekly attendance, non-denominational, and we can pretty much say with confidence that the Bible is not being preached there. Sin is not being talked about there. I listened to a clip of one of his sermons the other day, and he kept talking about mistakes and oops and things like that. Not sin. Not sin that Jesus died for, but it was just an oops. Oh, okay. Well, if that's the case, I'm really not too stressed out about my oops, you know? It's like I'm talking to a three-year-old, you know? It's unbelievable. But people clap and cheer. Okay? And then Life.Church, I don't know if you guys have heard this. Craig Grosher, we've got a book or two of his in there. Doctrine-wise, he's not so bad, but he's got this TV, internet type of church. Okay? 53,000 weekly attendance and online. The affiliation is fairly liberal. It does have, it still maintains traditional marriage, but they're going to ordain women preachers. They're going to do some other liberal type things that we and spiritual gifts and things like that. But he designed it as an internet-based church. That's his whole idea. And, you know, I'm all for going and checking out preaching and stuff online and listening to guys and things like that. There's nothing wrong with that. But that's not your pastor. It's not your church. There's no accountability there. There's no relationship there. I might hear some good preaching. Okay? And I'd say that about anybody that you think is good. If you're going and listening to John MacArthur or John Piper or Matt Chandler or whoever, or David Platt, or he's not your pastor. You can go listen to his preaching. That's totally fine. But if that's substituting church, you're missing the point of the New Testament church. Okay? And again, I think that, look, I watch preaching every week. I'm totally good. I might even give to the ministry. Why do I need to go to a building? Why do I need to go see people? I can stay in my room and watch this. Well, again, that's not the church. You've missed what this whole thing is about. Okay? Here's some other mega churches. We've got Saddleback Church in California, Rick Warren. Okay, Rick Warren and Bill Hybels with Willow Creek, they're the ones that instituted that whole seeker-sensitive kind of thing. You know, we're not going to offend anybody, and Joel Osteen has taken that and run with it to about the nth degree. New Spring Church in South Carolina, Perry Noble recently got fired for some alcoholism a few months back, but Clayton King is now the interim pastor there, but they've got 28,000 members. Bishop Eddie Long down there in Atlanta, which is just Heresy Fest, 2016. He is way off the chain, but 20,000 people. And T.D. Jakes down in Dallas at the Potter's House, he's a modalist, by the way. He doesn't believe in an Orthodox view of the Trinity, and yet he's kind of America's pastor, and President Obama brings him in, and he does all these prominent things and prayer breakfasts and things like that, and he doesn't even have an Orthodox view of the Trinity. Okay, that's a problem. If that's America's pastor, they put him on Time magazine and said he was the next Billy Graham. Okay, that's who we're talking about there. Okay, and the biggest church in North Carolina is Elevation Church out of Charlotte. Okay, Stephen Furtick and 19,000 members over 13 campuses. Okay, now I mentioned this a couple weeks ago, but Stephen Furtick preaches the gospel of triumphalism, which is God's going to break through in your life and give you great things. He may not call it material wealth, but he's going to call it spiritual breakthroughs. You're going to do these kind of things. And so I want to show you, he had a Code Orange revival, 10 days, where he brings all these different speakers in. And I just want to show you the speaker list that he has. And some of these guys you'll recognize. Of course, he kicked it off, which one of the podcasts I listened to says he doesn't do exegesis, he does narcissus, because the whole Bible's about him when he preaches. But there's Groschel there from Life Church. Louis Giglio, we usually like. You know, he's done some really good things, but he shares the stage with some really off people. He's associating. It's worrisome to me. It's troubling. Carl Lentz, Hillsong New York. He's the celebrity pastor. He's Bieber's pastor and all that. And, you know, he hangs out with those guys. John Gray is the assistant pastor at Lakewood under Joel Osteen. That's all that needs to be said there. Levi Lusko is he's one of these guys that's just like the most trendy pastor you've ever seen. You know, like skinny jeans and you know, he with his cool hat and his, you know, his glasses and everything's a pop culture reference. And even to me, it gets a little irritating, you know, way over the top on trying to be relevant. Christine Kane is a Word Faith with Hillsong. By the way, that Hillsong movie and all that, Hillsong might have some decent songs, but their theology is way off. Okay? They delve into that Word Faith prosperity stuff a lot, so be careful with Hillsong, especially the churches, even more so than the music. And then, of course, the Joyce Meyer, who is, again, heresy, heresy, heresy. She actually started her sermon, if you want to call it that, at the Code Orange Revival with a sex joke. So that was classy, the way to start the whole thing off right. But yeah, that's who we had in the pulpit. Well, what does that tell you? It means I don't have any rules. Anybody can come in here and preach. We wouldn't just give the pulpit to anybody. We're going to be really selective about who gets to get up here and talk. And it certainly wouldn't be Joyce Meyer. And it certainly wouldn't be people that delve into prosperity gospel. You know, and yet these churches are allowing these places in. Now, if you listen to some of his sermons, you go, his theology's not bad. You know, he's not talking about stuff that's way off the map, but what is he associating with and where is he relaxing his standards? And I think that's what we're seeing in churches. Why are so many people, why are 30,000, 40,000 people going to these churches? Well, because I don't really have to talk about my sin. I don't have to give that up. I can come in and blend in with the other 39,999. Church discipline is not even a consideration. Okay? Membership is easy. I can check the block and I can feel really good about myself, and it's an entertaining environment and there's live music and they probably got lights and smoke machines and everything else going on. That's what happens at most of these churches. So, and one of the things we've talked about many times with these churches is, what does it tell you when the music is live but the preaching is on a screen? Well, where's your priority? It's not the preaching of the word. It's not the preaching of the word. Okay? And that's what we're seeing in these churches. So I think that is a direct correlation with what we see in the family, is because the church has failed in putting forth, the church at large has failed in putting forth what a biblical ideal is. I think we've seen that filter down into families. Okay? And so that's my next one, is that's my little funny one there about Stephen Furtick. Aaron sent me that last week, so I figured I'd go ahead and share that with everybody else so everybody else could have a laugh just like me. And just like you won't see me in a Speedo, you will not see me in those jeans. Do not worry. It's a pledge I make to you in good faith today. So I think the lack of leadership in the church directly impacts the current lack of leadership in the home. So let me give you a disclaimer as this last little section here. Don't hear what I'm not saying, okay? Because I'm going to talk about the family setup. That doesn't mean if you're a single mom, I'm bashing you. Okay. It doesn't mean if you're on your second marriage, I'm bashing you. Okay. That's not the idea here. What we're looking at is trends in society, because I know different situations are different situations. Okay. So don't hear what I'm not saying. I don't think I'm criticizing every situation that everybody's in, because we've got different things going on. Okay. But look at this. Percentage of children living with two parents in their first marriage. In 1960, it was 73%. In 1980, it was 61%. In 2014, it's 46%. That's an alarming rate. That's dropping pretty rapidly as we see that. That means less than half of children are living with their two natural parents. Okay? Two-parent household in decline. In 1960, the two-parent household was 87%. In 2014, it's down to 69%. Now, that might not seem like that big of a jump, but that's still significant. That's almost 20%. And one-parent households were 9% in 1960. They're up to 26% in 2014. That's like 300%, okay, that we're jumping up. Okay, births to unwed mothers. 1960 was 5%. 2014 is 40%. Okay, again, that's quite a jump. Now, I thought this was interesting in the survey that I saw, because the majority of these births now occur to women who are living with their romantic partner. The majority of the increase is not people, you know, one night stands. It's people cohabitating. It's people giving up marriage for cohabitation. That seems to be the major contributing factor, at least according to this survey, of this jump in numbers. Okay, today's children, this is interesting. 7% of children are living with cohabiting parents. However, a far larger share will experience this at some point in their lives. Estimates suggest that about 39% of children will have had a mother in a cohabiting relationship by the time they turn 12. And by the time they turn 16, almost half, 46%, will have experience with their mother cohabiting. Okay? I mean, that's a big number. Oh, about half of the children will have their mother living with somebody that's not their father. Okay? Now, again, I'm not judging situations right now. I'm just saying this is the state of the family in America. Okay? And that's not necessarily a healthy thing for the family. Okay? Look at this. Women ages 40 to 44 in 1976 who had only had one child was 11%. And those that had, you know, two children, 24, three children, 25, four plus children were 40%, which that's kind of crazy. 40% had four plus in 1976. In 2014, 22% with one child, 41 with two, 24 with three, 14 with four. I mean, that's quite a drop from in the four plus category. Okay, what it said is we used to have more children. Now, why is that alarming? Well, when the Islamic community is having 5.5, 6 children per marriage, and we're having 2 and 2.5, do the math. Okay, that's what's happening to Europe right now. Okay, and we may be dealing with the same thing if we get certain, you know, people in power. Okay, that's what's going on here. So the lack of leadership in our country, I'm not even going to put any stats up because we already know. We know the lack of leadership in our country is absent. Okay, we don't have the moral compass anymore. We don't have that kind of stuff. So let's get through all that and get to some points back here in Judges. Shamgar was not the type of guy that becomes a deliverer of God's people. He was there because there was a lack of leadership. He was there because the Israelites failed. And God still provided, right? He still provided the unexpected, out of nowhere, you know, somebody to come in and deliver. And Shamgar was not supposed to be there. You know, and I used to, when I talked about my own personal testimony, that's kind of how I used to introduce it. And I can still say it today with confidence when I read this, is I'm not supposed to be here either. Okay, I'm not the guy that's supposed to be up here preaching to you. And by the way, another disclaimer, this is not about me. Okay? There's nothing about my story that's really about me. But to be, just when we look at the family situation, well, I was one of those kids that grew up in the broken family. You know, I was one of those kids that was supposed to come out of that and be the failure. You know, I'm the one with two alcoholic parents. I'm the one whose mom was out to lunch pretty much the entire time I was a kid. Okay? I was the one that was so angry at her and the world that I hated everybody and I hated God and I wanted nothing to do with Christ. I wanted nothing to do with the church. I thought it was the stupidest thing in the world. I thought anybody that would waste their time coming to church was an idiot, was a moron. Okay? And that the Bible was actually real, forget all that. Okay? I had no faith, no interest in faith, no desire to ever even open a Bible or darken a church door. And yet, why am I standing here? Because I'm a Shamgar, I guess, right? Because I didn't really have a choice in the matter. Because God needed to call somebody. And again, it's not me, all right? If you would have met me when I was 16, you would have thought, there ain't no way. This kid's going to kill himself before too long, okay? And then God just gave me height for no reason because he was like, we got to get him busy doing something or something's going to be a problem. So he made me 6 inches taller than anybody else in my family so I could play basketball and not get into too much trouble, you know, and moved all these different things in my life to bring me to himself when I was running the opposite direction. you know, and not just running the opposite direction, but shouting insults on him, at him over my shoulder as I was running the other direction, right? There's no other explanation for all this for someone like me to be here, because the statistics say that a kid like me, you know, and you guys know kids like me. Some of you might have been kids like me. You know, and we're not supposed to make it. The world says we're not supposed to make it. The world says we're going to be the problem kids in school. Okay, the world says we're going to be the ones that fall by the wayside. And there's no other explanation behind it besides God. You know, there's no way to explain it. I didn't even like to talk when I was a teenager. I didn't want to get up in front of people. I didn't want to stand here and speak words publicly. And yet, what am I doing right now? You know? Well, and again, it's not about me. I don't even like talking this way because it's way too much about me. But to look back and understand, it's what Pastor Sean talked about the other day when he said, "Thank God that I grew up poor." You know, it's the same thing with, you know, and I wasn't in that situation, but I grew up in a family with two alcoholic parents. Well, guess what I know how to relate to now? People that struggle with addiction. I know what it looks like. You know, I lived it every single day. You know what I can relate to? I can relate to the teenager that hates the world, because that's exactly what I was. You know, well, why did all that happen? That was my view back then. Why, if there's a God, I don't want anything to do with him, because look at my life. It stinks. Well, now I look back and it's like he was in total control of all that. He was preparing me back then to deal with stuff. Now, you won't hear me complain very much, you know, because, you know, there's not a drunk mother laying on the couch when I get up in the morning. I got a beautiful wife instead. And three boys. And I think that's what I relate to in this story. This one line of this nobody, this outsider, this guy that wasn't even in the family, that God said, "I need you right here, right now, in this time to do my work." And what did he do? He went, because God, it wasn't even a calling. It was just God sent him there. He didn't have any choice in the matter. So God uses different kinds of people. Okay, and I'm going later than I wanted to, but we'll finish up here. Consider this chapter. Othniel, the man, the guy that looks like the warrior, the guy that fits the bill. Of course, he's a judge. You know, Ehud, you know, the guy that's the schemer, the guy that, you know, a little bit underhanded, a little bit kind of on his own, the rogue guy, he gets to be a judge. And now this guy, nobody even knows who he is. This guy that gets called out of the wilderness somewhere shows up and kills 600 Philistines with a stick just to show that God is that powerful. You know, where none of us are probably Othniel. Okay? None of us are Othniel. Some of you might be Ehud, I don't know. But maybe a lot of us are Shamgar. You know, I think maybe a lot of us can relate to that idea. So God uses different methods. Othniel was filled with the Spirit. He conquered an enemy that he shouldn't have been able to conquer. Ehud was so smart and so, you know, calculating, he was able to pull off the impossible to get in with the king and kill him. And Shamgar might be totally oblivious to the whole thing. Have you ever had that experience where you've been totally oblivious that God was using you in a situation, and then later on you're like, "Well, that was totally God." You know, it's unexplainable. We don't have any reason to think that Shamgar was this great Hebrew warrior that was taking out Philistines left and right. He was just God's instrument. And I don't know about you, but that's all I want to be. That's all I want to be. I'm totally okay with that. I don't need the big house. I don't need the big car. I don't need the prosperity gospel. Just use me. Okay. And I'm going to fail, and I'm going to fall, and I'm not going to measure up sometimes, but just use me, Lord. That's the message I think we need to have. So the major lesson we should learn from Shamgar is that a shady personal background and a lack of proper equipment do not keep God from working through people who commit to doing his will. Okay. You don't need the best stuff. You work for the best God. You don't need the tools. He's got you. Okay? Many Christians think that because they don't have the good background or the best tools, they can't serve God. I mean, my wife and I have had this conversation because she's always grown up in a Christian home. You know, saved at a young age, two Christian parents, Christian school. She doesn't remember a time when she wasn't saved. And you know what we can do in this world is we can do both things. We can either get really self-righteous about that, or we can beat ourselves up because we don't have the testimony. You know, and you know, I told the kids this morning in Bible class, you know, people say, well, the best way to learn is to learn from your mistakes. No, the best way to learn is learn from other people's mistakes. I don't need to bang my head against the wall to figure out it's not a good idea. Right? I mean, that's so if that's your story, then don't feel bad that you don't have the testimony. You know, and if you're on the other side, don't think you're not good enough. I mean, how many examples do we have? Because that's my go-to, is no way, Lord. It was the same way when Pastor Sean asked me if I was called to preach. Nah, I don't think so. That's not me. I'm not that guy. Well, apparently God had other plans. You know, I mean, you don't need the proper equipment. You don't need the proper background. God calls everybody. And if we're all Shamgars here tonight, well, God bless us, because we're all Shamgars, you know, and we're not, and Shamgars in the family now, you know, we're in the family of God, and that's all that matters. So I hope that was as helpful to you as that one verse was to me this week, as I tried to get some personal application of it. Let's have a word of prayer. Father, thank you for tonight. Thank you. Thank you for what you've shown us here in this one simple verse. Thank you for saving us, and thank you for calling us despite our backgrounds and our lack of equipment and all the things that we would say are strikes against us. You saved us anyway, because we were sinners and you loved us first. And help us to serve you more effectively, Lord. Help us to lay everything we have at your feet. Help us to give you the glory for everything that you do, and not fall into these traps that this world has set up. And may our church here at Berean always stay strong with the Word of God, and how we preach it, and how we handle it, and how we love it. And we just want you to get the glory for all the things that we have going on here in your name, for your name, as more and more people believe the gospel. I pray your blessing. Keep us as we go out into the weather. Keep us safe, Lord, and give us an opportunity to glorify you this week. In Jesus' name, amen.